Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Susan Franson is a host of this show with plenty of help from Gina McAndrews and Paul Wearson. Welcome to you all.
Thank you, Mike. We're all happy to be here again in the Zoom studio. And we have some exceptional guests today featuring some of the things we're proudest of on Local Talk: racial and political diversity and the traditions of small towns in our listening area, as well as a favorite voice from the natural world in our phenology.
Introduction. So who's our first guest?
Dana James, a founder of the new online news outlet Black Iowa News. Welcome to Local Talk, Dana. I think I'll ask you to introduce yourself and tell us about Black Iowa News, how it came to be, and what audience you hope to reach. Great that you could be with us on this historic news day. Hi, Dana.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. Yes, it is definitely a historic news day. We have this great news coming out of the Georgia Senate runoff, where Raphael Warnock has pulled off an amazing feat, defeating the incumbent. That's great. And then you have the lead for John Ossoff is widening. So, you know, it looks like the Dems will be able to take control of the Senate. And that's great news for, you know, the direction that we want the country to go. So real exciting news coming out of there today for everyone that's waking up this morning. I started Black Iowa News back in May, and it's located at blackiowanews.substack.com. And like Susan said, it's an online news outlet, and I produce a newsletter also that is emailed to subscribers on a biweekly basis. And, you know, I'm a former newspaper reporter. I'm a lifelong Iowan. I live in Des Moines. And I really started Black Iowa News primarily to sound the alarm about the coronavirus, because at that time, there wasn't really, I felt, a lot of warnings coming out of, you know, media in Iowa that was specifically geared toward Black Iowans. And so, you know, at that time, it seemed like Iowa was more concerned about businesses rather than everyday Iowans. And so I wanted to sound that alarm. And so I started writing stories last May. When I began, Iowa had about 12,000 positive cases of COVID-19 and about 265 deaths. And so now you really see this explosion 10 months later with, you know, we're nearing 300,000 positive cases and 4,000 deaths. You know, nationally, COVID-19 is killing 1 in 800 Blacks. And so far, nearly 54,000 Blacks have died in this country, and at a disproportionate rate. And also in Iowa, even 100 Blacks have died reportedly. So, you know, I started writing things like how we are not in the same pandemic. And in one of those stories, I said, as the coronavirus swept across the country and Blacks fell like dominoes, I wondered if some Americans had ditched mitigation efforts so quickly because they saw the virus as being something that primarily affected people of color. And you know, Susan, early on, a disproportionate number of Black people were dying on the East Coast. They were being turned away from hospitals and sent home to die. And so some of these very stark healthcare disparities, we were really starting to see that come to bear. Now, here in Iowa, quarantine fatigue set in really quickly. Governor Kim Reynolds pushed for businesses to reopen, resisted mask mandates early on. And I really worried about how that would affect the well-being of Iowans. I was seeing on a lot of Facebook groups and social media groups that I watched that, you know, they were buying into, you know, the fact that businesses were reopening. And again, that alarm was not sounding. And so, you know, as we come forward in time, you see all these outbreaks in meatpacking that were disproportionately affecting people of color. And, you know, I worry that with everything that was going on also in the national media, that Blacks were getting conflicting and downright false information about the pandemic from the outgoing president, who spearheaded many disinformation campaigns. And also even Iowa's governor, who said that repeatedly she trusted Iowa's Iowans to do the right thing, as if. And, you know, the misinformation that's just been shared every day on social media. So all of these things were a big concern, a big fear. And so I began really chronicling everything that was happening. So I started writing really from my own perspective as well. You know, what it was like to be a Black woman in the pandemic, you know, seeing these stark disparities, but yet seeing, you know, really life go on normally for people, and people weren't acting like we are actually in a pandemic. And so then, you know, on top of everything going on with the pandemic, trying to stay safe, you had, you know, the explosion that happened, you know, when ex-Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin knelt on George Floyd's neck on May 25th, which kicked off, you know, months upon months of nationwide protests and even worldwide protests. And so Black Iowa News began to also write about the work of the Black Lives Matter movement here, the work of the Black Liberation Movement, and some of these star protesters that we have, like Matthew Bruce, who were doing, you know, fantastic work here in terms of organizing protesters and getting out, you know, important messages that needed to be delivered. And so in August, I wrote, while some Iowans enjoy their summer vacations on crowded lakes, packed amusement parks, and dine al fresco, I'm stalled at the intersection of two pandemics, racism and COVID-19. And as the saying goes, when white people catch a cold, Black people catch pneumonia. The pandemic that's currently ravaging this country sure seems to fit that description. And you know, when Michelle Obama, who I consider, you know, forever first lady, when she on her podcast said that she had a low-grade depression due to the protest and COVID-19, I really was right there with her, as were so many others. You know, Black Iowa News, I've written about bias in healthcare, which is so vitally important. I wrote, if I contract COVID-19 and I need hospitalization, there's a very real chance that because I'm Black, I may not get the best treatment or be offered, you know, life-saving measures or the best therapies. Studies really back that up, I found over my reporting. And medical professionals are aware of the bias and they're taking steps, you know, to try to fight it. But as a Black woman trying to survive this pandemic, you know, I've got to dodge COVID-19. I've got to stay away from other people and social distance and isolate. And then I've got to also dodge the healthcare system in many ways. So, you know, I can think back in 2019, before the pandemic began, I remember being the sickest that I've ever been. And, you know, fever and chills. I had a terrible sore throat. It felt like I was swallowing glass and I couldn't get out of bed. And after about a week of that, I finally gathered enough strength to go to urgent care. And at that time, I was in between jobs. I was about to start a job. So I was in between jobs and didn't have any health care. And I just figured I would pay the bill with a credit card. Well, I went in there and the receptionist, she, you know, offered me some financial aid papers. I was really sick. I took the papers. I went into the examination room and I set the papers down on top of my coat. Well, anyway, the nurse comes in and she's very cold. I got my first ever flu test. And, you know, you're used to nurses kind of telling you what's going to happen. Well, she just shoved the swab up up my nose as hard as she could. And I really froze, you know, tears sprang to my eyes. And, you know, I said, my gosh, you know, that really hurts. And she was just like, oh yeah, it hurts. Waved away my pain with no kind of empathy whatsoever. Later on, after some testing, the doctor comes in and he basically says, well, you're good to go. Yeah, there's a little something on your lungs, but you know, if you get worse, go to the ER. And he waved me out. He didn't offer any medication. He didn't tell me anything about what I could do at home in terms of, you know, over-the-counter medicines or self-care. And so I left there very dejected. It took me another 4 days of being really sick at home before I started to feel better. And, you know, I thought about how their behavior, you know, was it racism? Was it because of that financial aid form? Or was it both of these things that factored into, you know, really their lack of empathy? And so, you know, these are very real things that Black people have to deal with. I'm sure you're aware of Dr. Susan Moore, who recently died and chronicled her dealing in healthcare. She chronicled it over Facebook and really thought that being Black had played ultimately a role in her death. And if a Black doctor can't get fair and equal and great treatment and healthcare, then that's a problem for, you know, all Black Americans. And it is something that really is of highest concern. And so I'll never know for certain, like I said, if was it my race, was it the financial aid packet, but this implicit bias that we're really seeing play out in healthcare is playing into these COVID-19 disparities. And so I've been writing really extensively about that. Also with Black Iowa News, I've chronicled the No Justice, No Peace Super PAC, which is working, you know, on Black concerns at the legislative level now. I've talked about how structural racism harms Black maternal health. You know, Black women in Iowa face many healthcare disparities, but in terms of maternal health, Black women in Iowa are 6 times more likely to experience a maternal death than whites. And that is a travesty, and that is something that we really need to work on. I also wrote about a Black woman early on who had COVID-19. She, you know, told Black Iowa News readers about her experience, and hopefully these kinds of things, again, the goal is to help Black people stay safe and help us be able to endure, you know, and overcome this pandemic. So really, when it comes to what we're doing now, the focus has really turned to the COVID-19 vaccine and whether Black Iowans will, when they're able to, be able to get their shots. So, you know, I'm really watching what's going on in terms of how the shots are being delivered, if there are going to be enough shots. You know, there's a lot of concerns as you look across the country really with that. And I want to see how that plays out in Iowa, because that's going to be of vital importance as we go forward and try to get back to either a pre-pandemic, you know, way of life, or, you know, even what happens to us post-pandemic, if we're able to, you know, put COVID-19 in the rearview mirror, so to speak. So Black Iowa News is really subscription and contribution-based, but there's also plenty of free posts, and there'll be much more in it as the year wears on. And my goal really, Susan, is to grow Black Iowa News, create a legacy, produce very high quality journalism, and hire writers in other parts of the state that can speak to the Black experience statewide. And also, I'm really wanting to provide a platform for Black writers, Black content creators, and really showcase and highlight Black expertise. Ultimately, Black Iowa News will continue to be about providing information that's going to help Black Iowans outlast this pandemic and then go about making really the kind of positive and lasting changes that we need in the state in terms of education, policing, healthcare, housing, employment and all of these things that are very critical to the quality of life that we have here.
Well, thank you very much.
You are welcome.
You know, Dana, you are, of course, new to KHOI. And since the pandemic began, we have been focused on getting information out about COVID. We went from 3 days a week to 5 days a week so we could provide more information to our listeners. So this is just a new and fresh perspective on the issue that we all care about very, very much. Thanks so much for being with us today.
You are welcome. Thanks so much for having me. And again, you know, I hope your listeners find me at blackiowanews.substack.com. And thanks again for your programming.
Thank you so much, Dana.
Thank you.
And a little music to transition to our next guest.
What we need to survive together.
In case you just tuned in, we've been visiting with Dana James, founder of the new online publication, Black Iowa News.
Here on Local Talk, we're glad to be able to catch these stories which may be missing in our local papers.
Our next guest will bring us a different political perspective. When we try to get interviews from candidates running for office, many Republican candidates simply ignore our invitations. And since we have Democratic representatives for districts 45 and 46, they are the ones who usually give us updates on issues facing the legislature. Boone County has mostly Republican legislators, but the only Republicans who agreed to be interviewed, who did in the last election, were running in the primaries. So when I learned that the newly elected Black Republican legislator, Eddie Andrews, is from neighboring District 39, just across the Des Moines River from Polk City, and including Grimes, Johnson, and Urbandale, I was pleased that he was willing to come to talk to us as the legislative session begins. Welcome, Eddie.
Hi, how are you this morning? I am actually wonderfully, enthusiastically welcomed here.
Well, drawing off our previous speaker, are you aware of the No Justice, No Peace super PAC in the legislature?
I am not, but I'm certainly open to hearing more.
Actually, your legislative race was very interesting. You defeated a very well-funded incumbent Democrat.
Absolutely.
And I just wondered how you did it.
Well, thanks for asking, Susan. It really goes back down to basics. It was hard work. I would say hard work and connecting with the actual voters in the district. I made it a point to knock on every door that I could possibly knock on, some 15,000 doors. I was making sure that I was everywhere where people were. And whether that person was a hard Democrat, whether they're a hard Republican, if they lived in our district, I wanted to talk to them. I wanted to hear their voice. I felt like if I am applying for the job, which is exactly what this is, then the people who are hiring me should actually hear the person, hear me out, and not just hear what my vision is for the district and for the state of Iowa, but to get their feedback and what their concerns and what their issues are, and try to represent all Iowans.
Well, of course, you were in a Republican district, but you also were campaigning during COVID. How did you handle that?
Oh, great questions. So first of all, yes, we were in a Republican district, but not by much. It was very, I'd say we were purple district. And when we started campaigning in COVID, again, I felt like my applying for the job should be that I should be in front of everyone. So yes, what our campaign did is that in campaigning during COVID, now let me clarify, we were shut down like everyone else for 5 months. I want to say from like, I don't know, March to August or whenever that was. But when we got the okay to go out, I made sure that everyone was masked up on our campaign, and that we stood 8 to 10 feet back or more. We'd ring the doorbell, we'd stand back. And I think most people were appreciative of that, how we respected their distance, how we respected their safety and our safety. I was tested regularly. And guess what? We found out that it's easy to talk to people from 8 to 10 feet away. We can leave our material on their porch, step back, and as they open the door, they can grab it or not, or they can look down on it. And we made our case. And apparently we made it in enough cases that I was able to be elected and begin my honor duty to serve next week as I swear in.
Now, I've read your campaign literature, and you do have some really starkly different political perspectives than many of the Democrats. Do you think that there are areas where you're going to be working across the lines, or are you going to be more in opposition?
Well, I mean, I've always felt like I can talk with everyone, and then that I do talk with everyone. Part of my background is involves ministry, where what your political affiliation is absolutely the last thing that one thinks about when serving a community. I've served different ethnicities, different cultures, different languages, and it's all about helping people. And I didn't get into this because I thought one party was, you know, the golden ticket and the other party was absolutely wrong. I think there are so many ways that we can work together. For instance, mental health care is my biggest platform that I ran on. Well, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, we all get sick. We all know family members who are ill. And if we can fix that, then everyone wins. And so if that involves working with people of other party, I'm used to that. I've grown up a Democrat. And so I've, now that I'm a Republican, that won't change. So I guess in short answer, yes, I feel like I will work with whoever's at the table.
Well, thank you. You are really an unusual candidate because you are a Black representative in a suburban district. And I would imagine, I don't know the district, that your majority of your, great majority of your constituents are white.
Sure.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's Iowa. But, you know, I felt like the message that we had resonated with everyone.
What was that?
The message?
Yeah.
Well, I ran on mental health care. There are so many gaps, so many holes in the mental health care system, especially as it relates to parents with children. How do parents navigate that system? And I know that firsthand from our family, how we had to deal with that in our own family. And you realize that it doesn't matter how connected you are. Both my wife and I are somewhat well-informed public figures, and it was difficult for us. We knew who to call, but there were so many gaps and so many delays in care, so many not enough beds. We just realized that this is difficult. There's no real navigation. Every parent has to figure this out for themselves. And I figured that that's one thing that I could address and hopefully make easier for parents to navigate, to get their kids the proper help in respectable time.
Well, I was going to ask if you experienced any of the kind of treatment that Dana James described. I guess you were not unfortunate enough to be without health care coverage. Is that right?
Well, it wasn't so much about health care. It was about what was there, even with care, with or without care. And that was what was so troubling. For instance, there's 6, 8, 10 week delays sometimes on psychiatric or counseling care for children sometimes. And we were just flabbergasted that, well, what if there's an episode going on, a mental episode going on, and their response was, well, let's just hope someone cancels. And so we immediately saw that there was a need for professionals and providers who can actually address these issues. Or if a child is in a facility and they have to move from one facility to the next, often we've discovered that counselor or that psychiatrist is attached to that facility and not necessarily to the patient. And so if a parent moves one child from one facility to the next, even if perhaps he's gained trust with that particular psychiatrist, well, now they have to start all over with someone else. And that's not quite how that kind of care works. You need to work with that person. And that's an easy change that we can make. I also ran on education. I ran on strengthening all the options and safe neighborhoods, all those things. Talked about justice reform. We talked about all kinds of things that should benefit Iowans that are not necessarily party line issues. And that message resonated with a lot of people, whites, blacks, Asians, Latinos.
Well, this is certainly the beginning of a very, very interesting stint in the legislature. So we'll be watching you and asking you for some perspectives as legislation moves into our focus more.
Absolutely. I look forward to it. As we're sworn in next week, I can't wait to serve our community, and I look forward to communicating with you throughout the session.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and your hosts thus far, I guess because of some technical, have been mostly me, but Gina is back with us again, and shifting away from political issues with a Black perspective, we're turning to the Norwegian heritage more familiar to our listening area. For this segment, we are happy to have Paul Wiersen with us. Paul, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, and delightful to be on the program. It was interesting in your first segment to hear from both those guests, and now by the way, Susan, you do a good job of keeping variety on this show. So we're leaping now to Norwegian heritage, right?
Yes. And one of our guests, Diane Tott, has been the subject of articles in several papers, including the Ames Tribune and the Des Moines Register, as well as the local papers I've subscribed to, the Tri-County Times and the Nevada Journal. So welcome, Diane. Thanks for being with us today. And thank you for introducing us to our second guest, Gary Legvold. And thank you for joining us also, Gary.
Good morning, Susan.
Hello, Diane and Gary.
Hi, Gina. Good morning.
I've heard about your story and that it starts with the beloved walnut tree that was damaged during the derecho in August. I heard you had some rolling pins made out of it.
Yes, we sure did.
Do you want to tell us about your tree and your farm and,
sure.
and the history?
Sure. Well, it's a family farm, still owned by my mother. And my dad and my uncle farmed there for many, many years. And prior to that, my grandfather farmed there. And I was fortunate to be able to grow up there on the family farm with my cousins and spent many hours working and playing around on the farm. And this tree was always kind of a central point for us. It was busy all around, but the kids had a tire swing and what do we call it, a bag swing or a sack swing in one of the other trees there. And we just spent many hours in that area playing. And I have lots of memories of that tree. And then, of course, I have memories of also needing to pick up all the walnuts. And we would harvest the walnuts and shell them using an old-fashioned antique corn sheller and dry them and crack them. And on the cold winter nights, my dad would often sit and shell the nuts. And then later, my mom would bake with those walnuts. So it was just always a part of our lives in one way or another. And so when the derecho came and damaged the tree, and we decided it needed to come down, it was kind of tugged at my heartstrings. And I thought, we need to do something with that wood, something that we can keep as a memory of it. And I thought about it for days. I remember trying to figure out what I could do. And then all of a sudden this light bulb went on and I remembered Gary. He spoke at the Sons of Norway meeting in Story City. I think, Susan, you looked it up and it was in 2017. I was glad to know that time frame. But anyway, I remembered him and I could remember his name because he was the Lefse King. And so I could find him that way on the internet. And actually he's also published some books and I had purchased a couple of his books there. So I had his name that way as well. But, anyway, I got a hold of him and he knew that it could be done. And so he helped me in the process and, he knew, you know, where the wood should go and how it should be handled and everything. And he took over from there and got us going.
What did you have to do to get the tree ready for rolling pins?
Oh my. Well, Gary gave us certain instructions about how long the pieces needed to be. I think it was it 20 inches, Gary, or at least 20 inches. So, you know, we kind of went for a little bit more than that. We didn't want to turn up short. So it was a little bit longer than that, but, and so our tree man that did all the work around the farm one day, we had a lot of damage from the derecho. And anyway, he took care of making sure that the pieces were cut just so and got them ready for us to select some and go from there.
Diane, this is Paul. Yeah. I live on a few, you're over in the Roland area, is that right?
That's where my mother's farm is, yes. I live in Ames.
Yeah. Okay, well, I live 6 miles west of you, and I had the ratio damage here on my trees, too, so sure. I can really identify with that. Now, sure. What we're talking about here is fashioning rolling pins out of the tree, and we should point out that I'm Norwegian, too, by the way, on both sides of the family, so I have a rich heritage of Norwegian foods, too. Now, this rolling pins, the rolling pins we're talking about are kind of unique. We're all familiar with the smooth rolling pins. Now, these rolling pins, the surface is a little different. Is that right?
Right, right. I think Gary's the expert on different types of pins. This is the only type of pin that I've used to roll Lefse. That's what my family used, but there are other styles that are used. I don't know, Gary, how would you describe the crosshatch? I'm not certain how we can describe the...
Yeah, what? there's grooves going around the barrel of the rolling pin, and then there's grooves going the length of the pin as well. So you have squares, pyramids, versus the traditional one is just grooves around. And if you go to the Norwegian American Museum in Decorah, the old rolling pins that were brought over from Norway, most of them have the grooves going around, and they're treasures. They're just beautiful to behold, and then they have this gift of time on their side. That's the thing about these rolling pins. They just keep going. They're like a recipe card that just passed on and on and on. And Diane's gift of these 5 pins is this will be treasured through the generations.
That's a great idea because, number one, the tree has a lot of emotional connection and history with the family. And putting them into rolling pins to be used to make Lefse, that's another tie-in with the family and the heritage. And maybe for some of our listeners, we need to be more in an explaining mode about Lefse. So where do we start with that?
Well, Lefse is a Norwegian flatbread, and it looks very much like a tortilla. People are very familiar with that. Up here in Minneapolis, we make it with potatoes. Diane does not. We live with each other. We manage to tolerate each other. No, it's a great tradition, and you can put a lot of things in it. It's a holder of simply butter and sugar. You can put cheeses and meats and sauces in there. But it's something that has great meaning, like all flatbreads in every culture. It has great meaning to us. And then Diane's idea of passing on the tradition by making these walnut. I mean, walnut is just a beautiful wood. It's dark, and it's when you get flour on the pin, and the white flour contrasts with the black grooves and of the pin and the black and brown nature of the pin itself. It's a beautiful thing. So it's a great thing that she has done to her family, and I wish I could have been there on Christmas.
Oh, and at Christmas, that's when we brought the rolling pins out to show the family. Is that right, Diane?
Yeah, they were Christmas gifts. And my two sisters and I were able to be together with my mother and our families that day. And so we brought out the gifts, and everybody was quite surprised. We managed to keep it a secret. And they were very pleased, and my mom was pleased to see them and just to hold one in her hands and remember all her days of rolling Lefse. So it's a tradition that'll be carried on.
No, that's true, and I think that in my family background, too, and I did the whole Norwegian bit. Not only did I go to Story City High School, which, and of course, Story City and Roland are traditionally a Norwegian settlement originally, and I also went to Luther College, and so I'm very familiar with the Vesterheim Museum. and all the Norwegian heritage that goes on there. Of course, in Story City, we have Scandinavian Days. And up in Decorah in July, there's a gigantic Norwegian celebration up there, too. But in our family, the tradition also of Lutefisk and Lefse is a predominant background in both of my families, on my mother's and father's side. And Lefse, of course, as you say, is a flatbread. And it forms into a tortilla-like thing. You roll it up. We called it, in our family, a beta. When you use the flatbread to fold around whatever you choose to put in there. Lefse might enfold the lutefisk. It might enfold, in our family, it was lutefisk or cod and mashed potatoes and butter. This was a cardiologist's dream. You know, it was a heavy thing to eat. And so families have different traditions, as you pointed out. And it might be cod, it might be lutefisk, it might be a variety of things, and their sugar might be involved. I've seen it done in many ways, but lutefisk is particularly controversial because it has this remarkable aroma, and maybe one of you can describe that fish. It's a unique fish. How does it differ from what most people think of when it comes to fish? It's kind of a jelly thing, right?
Well, it if it's prepared badly, it's like a jelly. If it's prepared well, it's a firm fish. People tend to overcook it. I call lefse and lutefisk the great social igniters in the Scandinavian community. Scandinavians are known to be kind of stoic and quiet, but my feeling is everybody's got a lefse story or a lutefisk story. So you can be in the dullest party and just mention the word lutefisk, and pretty soon things are happening. People, oh yeah, that's that fish that, and then they got a story like you just described, Paul. So if things are dull, just say lutefisk and things will happen. As far as the aroma goes, I think that's, it's been, it, in the past it was much worse. They've fixed it. It smells like fish, and some people just don't like the smell of fish. So I make it, I like it, but it's a food that people love to hate. They love to make fun of it, take shots at it. But when they have the great lutefisk suppers and dinners that churches have, people don't line up for the meatballs. They come for the lutefisk.
Well, I have a question.
That's right.
When I first came to Ames, you could buy the dried cod, and that's what it is. This dried cod or preserved cod in Fairway. And I tried to prepare it once, and it didn't smell like fish to me. I wondered if I was going to be able to wash my pot so that the smell would go out of it. But it's something that's very, very particular. I mean, you can't just go and buy a lutefisk off the shelf, I don't think. Don't you have to use the dried lutefisk?
No, you can buy it packaged.
Or the preserved lutefisk?
Yeah, you can just buy it packaged and processed. And so you just open the package and bake it or boil it, microwave it even. So it makes it pretty simple now.
Well, you know, lutefisk had that unique aroma. And in the 50s, when a lot of the farm kids around here started to go off to college, and they might become engaged or have a relationship, but that came to the point where they brought them home to meet the family. And it was always a crisis if that person, the boy or the girl involved, brought home somebody who was from an entirely different culture, like an Italian girl or Italian boy or something, someone they met on the campus, and they encountered lutefisk. And we always used to joke that that was a deal breaker for a lot of engagements, because this person, totally outside the Norwegian culture, caught this aroma of lutefisk and thought, I'm not sure I could join this family. What is this stuff, you know? it's so foreign to and so unique to the Norwegian culture and the Scandinavian culture that you'd have to when you talk about other people from other cultures or backgrounds, it would have to be an acquired taste. For those of us who grew up in Norwegian homes, it's something we grew up with and were accustomed to. Now, in our family, Mom made the full lutefisken lefse at dinner, but she also made a roast for us Americans. So she labored hard on Christmas Eve to bring forth this Norwegian dinner and also the roast beef dinner. And of course, she was an equal opportunity cook. Okay, so we had the roast and we had the lutefisken lefse. But you know, the main thing about Norwegian culture is a lot of it, there's a lot of self-deprecating humor in the Norwegian culture. You've heard about the Lena and Ole jokes, you know. And there's a lot of jokes about lutefisk, a lot of jokes about, there's a cookbook I saw that was entitled Snowblind Cooking.
Thank you, Paul, and thank you, Diane and Gary, for joining us today. We have another program we need to move on to, but thank you so much. And we look forward to hearing more about the future of these rolling pins.
By the way, I'd like to put a plug for our website, because Gary has a wonderful description of this whole project on his website. And I'll put the link on for that. I mean, it shows the wood, it shows the whole process. And I think anybody who's interested in this issue and how these were made, I think would really enjoy seeing that. So thanks, Gary.
Thank you, Susan.
And as we close today, Pat Schlarbaum, KHOI's environmental reporter, brings us a phonology of the great horned owl. Let's listen in.
Phonology is writing down nature's happenings when they occur. The first snowy owl of winter or the last marsh hawk of the autumn are noted in a journal for future reference. Today's phonology is about great horned owls. Last evening, two owls were hooting while the moon was rising in the east. The air was clear and crisp, just right for breathing. Hoo, hoo, hoo. Then hoo, hoo, hoo. As they blended their mating calls, they flew into the acreage to their cherished perch near the rabbit habitat, consisting of shrubs and piles of limbs that rabbits cherish. Rabbits and owls feed a system of nature that is landscaped for wildlife, where I come from. The farmstead has 120 years of transition. A prairie marsh complex is what it was. Now it's rabbitat for rabbits, mice, foxes, hawks, and owls, and humans. Great horned owls are our largest native owl and are approximately 18 inches tall and weigh up to 4 pounds. Distinctive horns made of tufts of feathers adorn each side of their head. Great horned owls are the first birds to nest each winter, and they announce their nesting intentions with their calls to all that live in the woodlot. Often an old crow or red-tailed hawk nest provides a platform for their eggs. And they will be laying eggs soon. Yep, in January. To successfully incubate eggs in winter requires special anatomical features. Owls have an area on their belly or abdomen that does not have feathers called a brood patch. The area, about the size of 2 eggs, is bare skin. Feathers are designed to completely cover the brood patch. By teasing the feathers aside on the abdomen, the incubation zone or brood patch will be uncovered if you ever have a bird in hand. Both males and females will possess a brood patch, as both will incubate. Yet females, being larger in raptors, do the majority of incubation, particularly through the night. Once eggs are laid, Adults will secure the eggs by essentially wrapping their skin around the eggs so incubation can proceed successfully. By sucking the eggs into their abdomens, the body's warmth can be directed through the skin straight to the eggs. The feathers provide an overcoat of insulation to the system. Since one side of the eggs receives the best skin-to-egg contact, the eggs are turned or rotated often. Owls incubate eggs up to 35 days. Raptors typically lay 2, sometimes 3 eggs. A pair that successfully incubate 3 eggs will pass along those traits, genetically, to their young. It is believed that's one reason why females are larger than males in the world of raptors. The Decora eagle pair are illustrating this point. When an adult leaves the nest and is relieved by its mate, viewers can see the eggs in a triangle or 3 in a line. The female incubates the triangle orientation, and the smaller male, with smaller brood patch, lines up the eggs, one after another, to do the best he can. When great horned owls initiate egg laying so early, that provides an advantage to a predator of mammals and other birds. When their young are 40 days old or so, they are fledging or flying freely from the nest in March for the first time. And while young are achieving self-sufficiency in the following weeks, the young of their prey, mice and rabbits and other birds, are vulnerable to their hunting strategy and needs. As in The Early Bird Gets the Worm, great horned owls are called tigers of the night sky. They are the main predator of mammals or birds of the woodlot. In our current era, breeding bird surveys are indicating great horned owl numbers are not increasing, possibly due to a virus called West Nile virus. With fewer great horns, other raptors such as endangered barn owls are experiencing a recovery in Iowa savanna areas where grasslands meet the forests, or in our isolated farmstead woodlots. At any rate, great horned owl numbers will remain formidable to prey items, with the prognosis that great horned owls will always be with us, and their strategy to be the first to nest in January each winter secures their presence into the future. And that's our phonology for today. This is Pat Schlarbaum with KHOI Community Radio, 89.1, Story City, Ames. This environmental update is sponsored by the Outdoor Alliance of Story County, Story County's Conservation's Friends Group, working to enhance outdoor recreation, education, and conservation. Information can be found at www.oasco.org.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We've been your hosts, Gina McAndrews and Susan Franzen and Paul Wearson. And thank you for joining us today, Paul. Other voices you heard were Dana James, Eddie Andrews, Diane Tott, Gary Legvold, and Pat Schlarbaum.
Local Talk will be rebroadcast at 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories.
Local Talk was engineered by Michael Murphy. Thank you, Mike. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from the CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Ebony and Ivory by Paul McCartney and Stevie Wonder.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you become a member or renew your membership today. Just hit the yellow Donate Become a Member button. If you enjoyed the show, please tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.